This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we bring you two more presentations from the Economics of Happiness Conference held at Fort Worden on October 27th through 29th, a weekend-long event that brought together some of the world's most prominent thinkers, writers, and activists in the sustainability and localization movements to, quote, discuss, discover, and devise better systems for now and the future, as the event's website put it. The conference was organized by local activists with major support from Swedish visionary Helena Norberg Hodges' organization Local Futures, which has hosted Economics of Happiness conferences around the world, including in the U.S., India, Australia, Italy, and South Korea. This week we'll hear from Community Sourced Capital co-founder Rachel Maxwell and organic farming and urban agriculture pioneer Michael Abelman, who are both on hand to lead workshops at the conference. So now let's go inside the Compass. First up is Rachel Maxwell.
It is a great honor to be here, and I'm very grateful to the folks who asked me to come and speak to you. I am not an economist, and I studied art history as an undergraduate, so I appreciate art, and I was an art dealer for the first decade of my life career. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story because I feel like that's what I have to offer you. I don't have a lot of expertise, but what I do have is a story. I was an art dealer because I wanted to bring beauty actually into people's homes. And I did that for a decade on the East Coast, and I learned a lot about the market, weirdly. I didn't actually like it. I hung out with a lot of people who are extremely wealthy, and I needed to convince them to buy things that they didn't need. And I stopped being an art dealer when I gave birth to my first child, and we moved out here to the Pacific Northwest. My husband got a job at the then nascent University of Washington Bothell campus, and we didn't have a heck of a lot of money, but I stayed home with my first child at that time, and for a wide variety of reasons, and it was a good experience for me. But that first year, I became awakened to the greater economy and the way that the rules and regulations around the economy and how we measure things matter. And the way that I became awakened was I was doing my taxes. And I'd filed the EZ prior to that time, but we had purchased a home, a modest home in South Everett, and we were doing the taxes, and I was like, you know, taking the deduction-y stuff and things like that, and I was very excited about the fact that there was a child care tax credit, that this tax credit was going to make a world of difference to my family because we were going to get some money back. I, after all, was taking care of a child. Well, it turns out the child care tax credit isn't for taking care of a child. It's for paying someone else to take care of a child, which is fine and great. But I was like, what? I gave up a salary. Like, it cost me to take care of a child. And that was the first time that I recognized the power of our system to say what matters, because all of a sudden, my work didn't matter. It was unimportant. It wasn't even worth getting a tax credit for. That was my beginning awakening, and it was in the very same year that I was just tearing my hair out because we didn't have enough money to do anything, and life was difficult because we'd made this choice, damn it, excuse me, and like we should have gotten that child care tax credit anyway. And I was complaining to my friend who did get a child care tax credit, who's a corporate lawyer in New York, and so is her husband, but they get the child care tax credit. And it was like, I don't have enough money. I don't have enough. And she said to me, get over it, Rachel. No matter how much you have, it will never be enough. And her family is probably earning more than 10 times as much as ours. And I knew she knew. She was being honest with me. They didn't feel like they had enough. And I realized, I had this epiphany that that wasn't the world I was going to live in. I wanted to live in a world where I had enough. I had friends. I had a roof over my head. I had health care. What was not enough about that? So that was my awakening year about the economy and about the idea of this larger system of which gross domestic product is a part. And someone asked last night, or wanted, like, what are the one or two levers that we can, like, shift in order to make everything better? Yeah. I don't remember who that was, but I thought to myself, I know. Stop counting money as value. Money and value are not the same thing. So gross domestic product counts, obviously, money as value, and it's something that we measure everything by, and it's crazy. Because take this story that I heard from a hospital administrator talking about the complication of trying to make money as a for-profit hospital. And he said, you know, we make a lot of money when we amputate a limb from a diabetic. We make a lot of money. And we lose money every time we educate someone about how to take care of themselves. So that, I'm looking at my notes here because I'm going to read you my favorite quote about GDP, which no one has read yet, thank you. And it is, I'm not going to read the whole thing, a slightly abbreviated version of Robert Kennedy's statement about the GDP that he made in a speech in Kansas in 1968. He said that we had to confront the poverty of satisfaction that afflicts us all, which I call affluenza, thank you, John. And he was talking about that because, of course, measuring money isn't about satisfaction. He said, too much and for too long, we seemed to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product counts ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet, the gross national product does not count the quality of their education or the joy of their play. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. So I find that, like, profoundly helpful to me in my life. And after being an at-home mom and homeschooling my children, which also doesn't count, through middle school, I homeschooled them. I went back into the workforce, and I worked for a group that was working on international climate policy. And that was fascinating, and I learned a lot about our environment and climate. But it was after the 2009 Copenhagen talks when we failed miserably to create a new system of international climate policy that I was in a meeting with a bunch of sort of powerful men sitting around the table, and they were talking about this, and they were very depressed. But one of them said, but there's stuff going on the ground everywhere. And I thought, uh-oh, that's me. I have to be that person on the ground. So part of what it is that I did was I went to business school, and I learned at business school, taking a deep dive into what might sustainable finance look like. Renewable clean energy is a duh scenario. All we have to do is put the money to work to build the infrastructure. And I wanted to know why we didn't do that. And so I learned about finance and business school. And I came out believing that what we needed was a web of interconnected, resilient local economies, just like we needed a web of way that our energy system works. We need a distributed economy. And I created community-sourced capital, which was one way to help make that happen, but it was also a way to stop the whole idea that we keep having to build money and grow money. That growing money is the most important thing, because growing money isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is Gaia, is Earth. Life is the most important thing. So community-sourced capital sort of takes the growing money out of the system, and it helps small businesses access capital directly from the people who know and love them, and lots of those people get involved in helping fund a business, but they do it by sharing their money. And that means they don't grow it. They share it. What they grow is their community and the value in their communities. And what I invite you to do is to join me in the work that is creating this world that isn't about money. We use money. It's a great, useful tool. But it isn't an end in itself. And I'd like to close my talk with a poem that I find really helpful when I think about how challenging this work is. "Breathe," said the wind. "How can I breathe at a time like this when the air is full of the smoke of burning fires, burning lives?" "Just breathe," the wind insisted. "Easy for you to say if the weight of injustice is not wrapped around your throat, cutting off all air. I need you to breathe. I need you to breathe. Don't tell me to be calm when there are so many reasons to be angry, so much cause for despair." "I didn't say be calm," said the wind. "I said to breathe. We're going to need a lot of air to make this hurricane together."
So we have Michael Abelman here, who's down from Salt Spring Island. He's a farmer and an author, and he's been doing the organic farming work since the 1970s, and is considered a real pioneer. So we're fortunate to have him here with us. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me? Yeah. Well, I'm going to jump right in and take quite a different twist from where we've been. This is the downtown Eastside neighborhood in Vancouver, British Columbia, known as the Low Track. It's the ground zero home of the term Skid Row. Poorest postal code in the country, highest concentration of intravenous drug use, open prostitution, and drug overdoses anywhere in North America. Now, all of this exists in the heart of the gleaming steel and glass high-rises, pristine parks, art galleries, and restaurants, and the shiny new Mercedes-Benzes, Lexuses, BMWs that ply the streets of what is now considered to be North America's and maybe the world's most expensive city. But as Vancouver's prosperity is celebrated, its concentration of poverty and raw desperation endures in the midst of the polished and the preened. And if you walk or drive down the streets or back alleys of this neighborhood, you'll likely see someone pirouetting in the middle of the street, high on crack, or someone else sprawled on the sidewalk with a needle in their arm. Bear witness to these things, and it is difficult to not make judgments. We all have our deep-seated prejudices. We look the other way, walk a little faster, close the car window. But what we cannot ignore is that there is a thin line that separates any of us from that life on the streets. A divorce, death of a family member, childhood trauma, financial crisis, illness. Any of these things can push us over the edge. The amputee in a wheelchair, the woman soliciting John's on the corner of the street, the junkie sprawled on the sidewalk, each has a heart and a soul and the desire to do something meaningful in the world. How could we offer that opportunity? Well, 8 years ago, we started on a half-acre parking lot next to a dive hotel with a bunch of wooden boxes full of soil and a ragtag crew of 11 people from this neighborhood. There was no big idea or grand philosophy, no bleeding heart attempt to save anyone, just the simple idea that planting seeds and growing food, providing a reason to get out of bed, might allow other things to happen as well. We took abandoned and abused land and employed abandoned and abused people. We did what had never been done on this scale before, and we did it with folks that no one ever imagined could accomplish anything. If I didn't have this job, where would I be? Dead? In an alley shooting up? Or in a penitentiary? Now that's straight talk from our coworker Lyle, who is not prone towards dramatic or romantic reflections on a life that has included robbing banks, providing collection services for drug dealers, and surviving a jump off the top of an 18-story building. The job that Lyle is referring to is farming. Now, not the kind of farming you might think if you close your eyes and think farm. No cows grazing in vast green pastures, no welcoming farmhouse or tractors cultivating. These farms are on parking lots, under bridges, on abandoned urban lots. Now, I've spent 43 years growing organic food commercially. And along the way, I had a sobering revelation. The majority of high-quality food I was producing was going to a very narrow segment of the society, those who could afford it. But isn't good food the birthright for everyone? We all have to eat, and we all have to eat well, but equally important, we all need something meaningful to do in our lives. So after growing food for the privileged, I felt like it was time to work with those who were not. And not by giving them food, but by giving them the skills and the space to grow it. In the mid-1980s, I started what I called the Center for Urban Agriculture. Now, you have to understand, in the mid-1980s, when you use the words urban and agriculture in the same sentence, you were considered to be a little strange. Supermarkets at that time had pulled out of many low-income neighborhoods. Those same neighborhoods had numerous abandoned lots and throngs of people without work. I had what I thought at the time was a big idea. What if we could convert those abandoned lots into farms to grow jobs and production quantities of food? I started here. These are old slides. Former home of the Watts Health Clinic, burned down during the uprisings in 1965. Another neighborhood that is renowned for its incredible poverty. We removed thousands of pounds of trash and rubble and hauled in our tractors from an hour and a half north from the farm where I was operating and employed local youth to help us plant. A noble idea. But if you haven't noticed, my skin is not black or brown, and I'm not from that neighborhood. So while that project was a great success agriculturally and has had an influence to this day, I had to accept what a dangerous thing it is to think you know what other people need. And I also had to dig deep and ask myself what it really means to help, and how do we do it well? Now, 30 years later and 1,200 miles north, with a little more life experience, we're farming on parking lots and large plastic containers bursting with salad greens, arugula, spinach, peas, melons, tomatoes, and more. And I'm just going to show you really quickly a series of slides. These are pretty substantial scaled farms in the city. Go ahead. And we're going to just zoom through them. Forgive me. These are our tunnel houses, 16,000 square feet of high tunnel houses. This is the before of an orchard that we have. There are 800 trees. This is what it looked like when we started. This is me planting the first tree. This is 2 years later. Now the trees have 8 and 10-inch diameter trunks. They're 20 feet tall. Shiro plums, persimmons in British Columbia. And the orchard from the air. Yep. Donna, Kenny, Miranda, Jesus, and Lyle. Now, we call this soul food street farms. Our work is about recovery. One handful of seeds, one bucket of compost, one parking lot at a time. 8 years, 75 people employed over those years, several millions of dollars in wages paid, 4+ acres of pavement, thousands of growing boxes, a large urban orchard, which you saw, 25 tons of food produced annually. And for every dollar we pay our staff, an estimated $2.25 savings to the healthcare, legal, and social systems. Now, our staff come together each day in one of four different farm sites that are either parking lots or former contaminated brownfields. They spend their days growing food for the community. This is not some sort of make-work volunteer program. These are paid jobs on production farms supplying Vancouver with excellent quality food. Our program includes not just agricultural training, but life skills as well, things like canning and cooking, basic financial literacy, and more. We have a breakfast program. Teach people how to drive, provide rain gear when necessary, take them to the hospital, or pick them up from jail. Now, we are not social workers. We're not addiction experts or mental health professionals. We are farmers who recognize that the simple act of planting seeds, nurturing plants, harvesting food, and feeding a neighborhood can heal individuals in the world. And we have seen in the people we work with that the simplest of solutions can have the most profound impacts. Reflecting on her journey, Donna, who worked with us for the first 4 years of the project, said, "What's the use of being sober if you don't do anything with your sobriety?" And Alan, who went from hardcore crack addict to farm supervisor, he did this while raising two stepkids, both with fetal alcohol syndrome. And I used to tell Alan how much I couldn't believe and respected his resiliency and what he had achieved, and he never believed me or acknowledged what I was telling him. Self-respect is certainly not a trait that is common in this neighborhood. And Kenny, our first neighborhood farmer, told me that he comes to work on the farms feeling miserable and leaves feeling relief and hope. And I'll never forget planting tomatoes with Kenny our first season, when everything was new and a tomato plant was not just one more tomato plant, but something to behold. And I don't think he noticed, but I watched Kenny just looking at one of those plants, in awe of its fragile nature. And I sensed in that moment that he realized that plant was dependent on him for its survival. And when the first red tomatoes ripened on those plants, all of us came together to sample our work. And I got to watch that crew's expressions as their brains registered something truly amazing, something so new and so real and so beautiful. Working this way, delighting in the world we share, is eye-opening, and still with eyes wide open on the world, the pain, the poverty, the pull of drugs, it is impossible to not feel the suffering that is likewise common to us all. We all get our share. But how do we respond to the suffering of others? We need to start by recognizing the difference between compassion and pity, and I'm not sure the latter has ever provided much relief. Compassion can be as simple as providing living soil for people to put their hands in, the training to do good work, and a sense of purpose and belonging. Compassion is transforming forbidding urban hardscapes into living, breathing, biologically dynamic places that not only nourish our bodies, but open our hearts. Nova, a former meth addict and street kid, refers to her soul food tribe as her farmily. Love it. Farmily implies community in all of its manifestations. Nova tells me she bristles when someone refers to one of the farms as a gardener, our staff as gardeners. It's a sentiment I would never have imagined from these people that I work with, but I certainly resonate with it. You know, if you've been out there in the middle of acres of food digging beds or transplanting, or it's a harvest day and there's a truckload to be harvested, you don't exactly think of yourself as a gardener. But to have that recognition, that distinct identity, to think of your work of planting seeds and making lots of food as a profession, not a hobby, and to know that your hands are growing for 100 times your own self is deeply satisfying, especially for the folks we work with. We, as farmers who represent only 1.5% of the population, are like a bridge to another world. And the crowds that converge several times a week at the farmers' markets are seeking something more than fresh food. They want the stories. Why the berries are small this week, but so incredibly intense in flavor. They linger and taste and watch us as we work, strong and sure with dirty, rough hands and funky clothes and ruddy complexions. They watch us as we jive and joke and share recipes and tales from the land. And I realize that there is a deeper soulful nourishment that our society is desperately longing for, a hunger that cannot be satisfied by simple calories alone. This nourishment cannot be obtained from food that travels an average 1,300 miles from the field to the plate. It can't be absorbed from a package or from the shelves of a supermarket or from anonymous ingredients floating out of context. The kind of nourishment I'm describing is based on relationships, local, biological, interpersonal, ecological. It is the result of understanding connections, knowing the person who grew the food, knowing that they were paid a living wage, knowing that the land has been well cared for and protected from development, knowing that the food has not been assaulted with an array of chemistry and that its genetic makeup hasn't been messed with. But most importantly, knowing that everyone has a place at the table, equal access to real food, and the opportunity to do something meaningful in their lives. Now, I have to be honest, it's a little weird that I'm the one that's standing up here today telling you this story. You know, I've always had good food to eat, a roof over my head, loving relationships, beautiful children. I have no idea what it's like to be living in poverty or strung out on opiates or abused as a child. So the real heroes of this story are those not very far from where we comfortably sit today, who are wrestling with demons and challenges that many of us could never endure. So in the midst, and I am ending here, in the midst of all the ain't it awful hand-wringing going on these days, let's try to remember that for every global crisis, for every disaster, for every mean-spirited, narcissistic world leader, for every act of terror or sign of climate collapse, there are a million stories of hope and possibility. Soul Food Street Farms is just one of them. Create those hopeful stories. Seek them out. Participate in them. There is so much magic in the world. I experience it every time I witness the miracle of a seed germinating, or on early morning walks when I linger long enough to receive small fleeting gifts, like drops of dew on taut squeaky cabbages reflecting the light of the world. Or when I remember members of our staff at Soul Food Street Farms like Alan or Nova, who came to us in the grips of gnawing addiction, but are now thriving and highly skilled, productive farmers. We may feel paralyzed when faced with the enormity of our modern dilemma, but we have enormous power in and around the places where we live. So come back home, nurture and nourish every living thing you encounter, and reimagine, replant, and re-inspire your world one seed, one farm, one meal, one individual at a time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bringing you Economics of Happiness Conference presenters Rachel Maxwell and Michael Abelman, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Compass. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. In addition, KPTZ Compass recorded many of the presentations at the Economics of Happiness Conference and is making them available under KPT Specials in the podcast area of our website. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.